welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Bob Scott, former co-founder of the Kansas City Fellowship and the author of three books. The latest is Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, the Kansas City Prophets, and the International House of Prayer. Bob, it's good to be back. It's been a little bit of a delay connecting. We've both been kind of tied up for a while. And I was thinking as I was reading your Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, it's the perfect name for the subject that I'm getting into today, which is the cover-up culture. Mm-hmm. I have had so many people ask me about cover-up culture in various ways. And I've been, I don't know if you know this or not, I've been exploring this with Che On's former sister-in-law. I believe it's her sister-in-law. She has been, she's been through hell and back, obviously, but she wants to explore the cover-up culture within NAR. And so I've been going down some of that path with her. But I was thinking as I was talking to her, and I was thinking as a question come in about this, many people look at cover-up culture and they focus it to the leader. They say this is a leader problem. The leader's trying to cover up his or her, whatever they did. But it's actually much bigger than that. There's a reason why it exists in the way that it does in the charismatic movement. And yes, while it exists in almost every denomination, it is just a bit different in the charismatic movement. And I want to talk through that just a bit. So welcome back.
Thank you. For those that don't know, I've been trekking up and down Italy, having the time of my life, feeling like today that I woke up from a dream, because the last couple of weeks were just so amazing exploring Italian culture and everything, that I'm having a hard time feeling like I don't really want to wake up.
Yeah.
I had so much fun. I want to stay in the dream. So yes, this is, it's great to be back, and it'll sober me up a little bit from my 2 weeks of kind of living in a fantasy vacation world.
Anything we can do to sober Bob up is a good thing. Yeah. So I'm glad we're back.
Yes. And if I have glitches, it's because I keep waking up at 2 a.m. and I can't remember names and things like that. But this is an interesting topic. You know, for those that have followed us for a long time, you know, I grew up in Milwaukee, a Roman Catholic. And when I was about 11 or 12 years old, my mom yanked us out of the Catholic Church, and I never knew why. And it turns out that the cover-up culture that we know in the Roman Catholic side of things actually happened in Milwaukee at St. John's School of the Deaf, where a group of deaf boys had for decades claimed that they had been abused and nobody would believe them. And finally, they got the Milwaukee Journal, a writer from the Journal, to actually go public with it. And that's the shot that got fired that then started a whole domino effect in that subculture. And of course, in typical fashion, the Protestant side of the equation got arrogant and cocky, and those damn Catholics, you know what I mean? And yeah, those and all the I heard all the things from that side of the equation. And I don't think people realized we had our own skeletons in the closet. And to your point, it's, you know, people tend to always want to point to the leaders, but I think there's some underlying things that are even on the congregational side that need to be addressed. And one, there's two that I can think of, and I'll state them, and then I'll let you kind of take it from there. But the first one is that we have a default setting. I'm not sure where we got it from, but we have to look good so God looks good, right? So a lot of the facade that comes in the church world of people pretending they're more spiritual than they are, it's all predicated on this thing, well, we got to look good for everyone else. I think that's one side of the equation. The other side of the equation is people are embarrassed. In other words, those that have been in situations where their faith has cost them something, and their family or their relationships have been very critical about their choice, you know, to pursue God or go to a church or such. Suddenly now you look bad, right? It's like all your friends and relatives are going, see, we told you, right? And it's embarrassing. And so I think there's kind of this human element here where, you know, we're embarrassed. And so we want to cover it up. You know, it's, and I think we've all seen this in family situations, you know, it's like circle the wagons. You know, let's circle the wagons now. We gotta protect the reputation. You know, we see all this dysfunctional behavior, and I think, you know, it's playing out again.
You know, it's interesting because I grew up in a movement that was so strongly against the Catholic Church that there was no greater enemy. The Catholic mm-hmm. Church was the epitome of everything awful that's described in the Bible.
Sons of Satan.
Yeah. And once I actually got to know some Catholic people, and I realized that it's not the people that are a problem, if there is a problem as big as they portrayed it, which I don't really think there is as big as they portrayed it, but the people are really good people. And what's interesting about it is Catholicism is much like Protestantism in that you have a variety of different flavors. You mm-hmm. have those that probably are deserving of some of the bad things that was said in the movement that I came out of, probably, mm-hmm. because you had the extremist Catholicism. And then on the other hand, you had some of the more devout, holy, I mean, people who live just pure lives, love God, love Jesus, and all of the nonsense about the worshiping Mary instead of Jesus, none of that is true if you meet one of the devout Catholic people. So I had to kind of relearn everything that I'd learned about Catholicism. Mm-hmm. But in doing so, I still in the back of my mind had this thing, they're covering up all of the abuse. And it's really hard to get that out once you've been indoctrinated with this, because all you see when you have that frame of mind, all you see are the bad things. Every newspaper article that prints it, every news report, suddenly your mind mm-hmm. goes, well, that's all of them. And that's how you brand it. Mm-hmm. You can do the same thing on the Protestant side if you're a Catholic, which is kind of funny.
Right.
They see the Mike Bickles. They see the, you know, all of these different people that are doing things that are either unethical or just outright, in some cases, it's illegal. Some people have gone to jail for it. They look at those from the Catholic side and say, look at the mess that the Protestants have.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And it's not that I'm trying to find a middle ground in this episode, but what I am trying to do is show that there is a difference between that. And you actually hit the nail on the head early in the episode. It is about the people, but for a different reason than people realize. So in the cover-up culture that exists in the charismatic movement, we have what is called the Moses model, which I'm going to try to describe. I saw some people wanting me to go deeper with the Moses model explanation. The Pentecostal movement, combined with British Israelism, taught this notion that all of the blessings and curses that you read in the Old Testament, those were fulfilled in part, in type, and we'll get into the types in another episode, but they were fulfilled in type with the ancient children of Israel, but we're seeing them replay today, which is odd, but it takes a step further odd. If you're living that type of lifestyle and you're reading the Old Testament, well, there is a clear hierarchy, and Moses is the kingpin of that hierarchy in the Old Testament. He is the one that God gave the Ten Commandments to. And the charismatic world, you would say he is the one who divinely spoke to God. And so therefore, hear ye him, Moses. But what's different about the New Covenant is it's not the same structure. The Holy Spirit is the one who leads and guides you if you believe the New Testament. The Old Covenant was completed with Jesus dying on the cross, and now we've entered into a new covenant. Jesus lives in our hearts. All of the blessings that are described in the New Testament is different. But in Pentecostalism that adopts this, because of the way they've adopted it, they have to have a Moses for today. And so they're looking, in our group, we looked at William Branham. He was the Moses of the day. And interestingly, the groups and many of the historians say that he was trying to be Elijah or the return of Elijah. But before that, he actually was trying to be Moses. his one of his many commissions. He says, the angel told me, as Moses was given three signs, so are you given three signs or two signs. He got the number of signs wrong, which is kind of funny. I think he said two signs. But the thing of it is, once you establish that Moses model, what happens when Moses falls?
Right.
That's really the problem here, and that's what I wanted to explore.
I think the phrase that I've probably most associated with what you're talking about, the way I define it, is the man of God model, right? There's a singular individual who God chooses and anoints, right? And we all rally around him or her. That's very, for people that are not, whose whole life has been in the Pentecostal world, that's their normal. But that's not normal outside of that world. But yeah, that man of God model, which, you know, it's sort of like political ideologies. You know, the most efficient form of government is a dictator, right? But it also has the greatest weakness. And I think it's the same concept within the church world. It may be more efficient, but it's filled with all kinds of landmines and trapdoors. And frankly, in my experience now, 50 years into this, I would say a significant amount of people I know of have fallen into those cracks, crevices, and trapdoors.
Absolutely. And it really comes down to this. It is, in both cases, what you're describing, what I'm describing, they're similar. I do have actually a little bit of a difference, but in what we're both describing, it comes down to this central point. It's the anointed leader problem.
Right.
You have the person who's anointed, and if you're following that model of religion, there's a real problem if you start to question the leadership, and that's why they say, touch not God's anointed. That becomes the shield.
Well, it's the accountability factor, right?
Absolutely.
Right? That person is unaccountable to anyone else because there's no one above him, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in doing that, what happens is it does go back to the congregation. Loyalty becomes a spiritual value. The more loyal you are to the leader, the more devout you are. Your access to God is through that central figure. So therefore, if you're loyal to that central figure, you're in return being loyal to God. And so if the leader falls, you really don't know what to do because my devotion to God is actually through this human.
Well, I think the vulnerability on the congregational side is pretty simple to explain because whether it's in the church world or in the business world or anywhere else, when you're young, you're looking for father figures and mentors and, right? You don't really know how to navigate life. So you're looking for somebody to follow. And, you know, Jesus, there was a reason why Jesus used the analogy of people as sheep,
yeah.
You know, it's because he understood human nature is to follow, right? We follow, right? We're not often very confident in our own understanding. And so we default, right? And in the church world, it's particularly poignant because now we add a spiritual dimension to this, right? And now, you know, now God's involved, right? God's chosen, right? So now this has escalated to a whole nother level. So even more dangerous to challenge that because now you're not just challenging the leader, you are challenging God Almighty himself. How dare you, right? And so, you know, I have not seen, you know, because, I mean, those that don't know, I've spent 40 years consulting and counseling high-profile leaders that are these anointed men of God, you know, and it's a dangerous place. What it does to them in terms of their psyche and their soul and their understanding, it's very, very dangerous. It's a drug. And they get addicted to it, and that's why things go off the deep end, right? But getting back to what you're talking about, what is it about us as human beings? Because here's what's interesting. When my book came out a couple years ago, there were two audiences. They had very different reactions to it. It was very fascinating. the KCFers, which was my boomer generation, right, that are 60 and older, their reaction to the book was, huh, I always wondered about that. You know, I never was able to really figure a few things out. But man, I've been on my own journey for, 30 years, and I'm good. You know, I mean, this doesn't shake me one way or the other. I have my own relationship with God, right? They're mature now, right? They're not needing affirmation. They're not needing direction. It's like, I remember John Wimber telling me when I was in my 30s that I wouldn't get secure in myself until I turned 60. And he goes, when you turn 60, you're going to be comfortable in your own skin for the first time. And that's turned out to be true for a lot of different people. On the other hand, the younger crowd, right, the millennials, were having panic attacks and leaving their faith and absolutely, felt untethered, right? It was like everything that was their security blanket, their sense of identity and value and purpose was all ripped out from underneath them, and they are in panic mode. And so it's fascinating just watching this, right? And so I think a lot of that plays into what you're talking about from the congregational end of it, from the human side, depending on where you are in life, impacts you differently.
And that's actually the perfect introduction to the example that I wanted to use for this. I come up with these off-the-wall examples, but they really make sense to some people, and hopefully this one does. There is a problem that exists in humanity, and it's not just the narcissistic personality disorders. All of the things that everybody goes to is usually a psychological problem, but it's not always that. Because you have to understand the leaders who become the Moses in this Moses model figure, the reason why they have a cover-up culture to begin with is because the group collectively has to keep moving or the group implodes. And the best example to go to for this is a movie that I would have at one time thought sacrilegious. And in many ways, I know people will probably say it is and they'll hate me for this, but I'm going to say it anyway. There's a movie called The Invention of Lying. Have you seen this movie?
No. Now you got me curious.
Okay, so here's your homework for today.
Just so you don't feel so bad, God speaks to me through movies all the time.
Yeah.
And as I've said to you before on the podcast, in some ways, I think the Hollywood scriptwriters are more prophetic than people in the church, which gets me in trouble all the time. But I hear God speaking all the time through them,
Yeah, yeah.
So go ahead. I want to hear about this movie.
Yeah, and this one, oddly, if you watch it to the end, it does have a heartwarming thing where you can kind of connect to God in that way. But in the beginning, there isn't really a God concept. This is a town that exists who knows where not a single person has ever lied in their entire life.
Oh, my goodness.
And Ricky Gervais is the main character in this. His mother starts dying, and she's at the hospital. He's meeting with her. He's down on his luck. He feels awful because she's dying. And the mother says something to the effect, where do I go after this? And the doctor looks at her straight face because nobody has ever lied. And he says, oh, you're going to go into a dark box, and you're going to be there underground for the rest of your life, and you won't exist anymore. And she starts pleading with, no, that doesn't happen, right? And Ricky Gervais tells what is called the first lie in this, and he says something to the effect of, no, you go to this wonderful land where you'll be young again. And everybody wants to know more about this wonderful land, right? So they all come up to him. They're asking him, well, tell us more about this place. Well, it's the invention of lying because he is not a religious man. He doesn't know what exists on the other side. Mm-hmm. He's asked descriptions of it as though he does know. And
so he's just making it all up.
He's pulling it straight out of his butt. And I'm not going to ruin the movie because it is worth watching. But there is one point that I'll ruin because it's so outlandish. It's kind of funny. It gets to the point where everybody is after him as the source of information of all truth.
Okay.
To the extent the news media is coming, the city, everybody's swarming his house, and he can't even go out to eat, so he orders pizza and they bring it to the door. And the people are out there screaming, tell us what God says, tell us what. And he writes down 10 things on the ripped pizza box and walks out with his new, here are the 10 things that you must do to be good to each other. And the climax of it is basically one lie leads to another, leads to another, and it can grow so out of proportion where people will look to you as though you are the divine source of truth. Interestingly, in some of the research that I have done, I have found that there seem to be really, really good people who maybe they did have a personality disorder, maybe not, but they said something that wasn't quite true and people believed them, and it snowballed until they become the central figure of their own cult. Now, can you blame the leader for this? Not really, because they're just saying something that isn't true and the crowd's listening and wanting more. Right. The crowd has shut off God completely. We want to know more through this human about God. Let him tell us. Let's don't read our Bibles or ask the Holy Spirit. We need to go to this human. And so what happens is this, back to the cover-up culture. When you're in that mindset where you literally have shut off all of your own thinking, you become a parrot, a parrot of this guy who's just pulling stuff right out of his butt as he's talking. There comes a point where if the leader falls, you're so invested that you have to pick him back up. It doesn't matter what he's done. He could rob a bank. He could kill somebody. He could adultery, whatever it is. You have to pick him back up, because if you don't, your personality is so intertwined with his personality that your own personality starts to suffer.
Sidebar, one of my favorite all-time movies was Peter Sellers' last movie called Being There. And it's the same kind of concept. He's a mentally slow gardener who gets kicked out of an estate and ends up having world leaders sitting at his feet by the end of the movie. It's hilarious, but it's very much to your point. Yeah, interesting. One of the things that I went through, and again, I discussed this a little bit in my book, I found myself married into a family that was sired by two flaming alcoholics. Their children, i.e. Mike and his six siblings, all had very interesting personalities that were different from my normal, and I was really struggling to understand it until one day I was walking down a mall not far from my house that had a bookstore, and up on the shelf was a book called Children of, I believe it was something like Children of Alcoholics. And I was like, hey, it's kind of my existence right now. This is it. So I pull it down and start reading, going, oh my gosh, this is really interesting. One of the dynamics that the book talks about is a concept they call circling the wagons. And circling the wagons is a dynamic where the children who are utterly embarrassed by their, in this case, it can just be one parent that's an alcoholic, a drug addict, you know, something, you know, they're disruptive in the family. They're embarrassed, right? It's an embarrassing situation. When you got two, now it's, you know, now this thing has reached a whole nother level. So what they do is they circle the wagons and they create a false narrative, right? Because they don't want to go to school. Who wants to go to school and go, hey, my parents are drunks, right? Yeah, my parents came home last night. My mom's pants were inside out. Like, what were they up to, right? It's like nobody wants to be that kid, right? So what ends up happening is you create this whole culture where the older ones sort of create the narrative, and then underneath, everybody's sworn to loyalty. We've got to keep the secret, right? We've got to hide the secret. We got to circle the wagons. We got to create a false narrative that makes us look good. And I realized that over time, that while this happens in families, it also can happen on a macro level in the church world, right? And it's driven by shame, right? We don't want to be ashamed. And so I'm trying to bring a human element here of to why we fall into this trap of going, no, we can't talk about this. Because I'm running into this. In fact, there's some big Christian leaders that have come at me pretty hard about my book, because they feel like that I'm the son of Satan because of the fact that I want to critique, not criticize, critique. Those are two very different words with two very different end results. What's going on? Because my goal, I want to be better, right? But there's this whole, I want us to improve. Like, okay, we failed miserably. How do we get out of this? That's why at the end of my book, I talk about the issues underneath. Let's get somewhere. Let's learn our lessons and move forward here somewhere. Sorry, I'm being very Italian today. I notice my hands are going like this. That's what happens when you spend 2 weeks in Italy and everybody's doing this. So anyways, so that's one of the things for me that I see happening right now, because we've, you know, a lot of people want to talk about the IHOP situation, but we've been through 2 years of one revelation after another of human brokenness at high levels, right? I mean, this isn't just an isolated situation. Either God is up to something, right? The Holy Spirit's flushing things out, or we just seem, we're caught into one of these cultural moments that's a wave, right? That's just reproducing itself. I don't know which it is. I mean, you hope it's the Holy Spirit, but it could be just a cultural thing. I don't know. Nonetheless, you're seeing two very different reactions, right? There's one group of people that's going, hey, bring it into the light. We want to see it. We want to acknowledge this is happening, and let's solve the problem. We got another group of people that are going, no. This makes us look bad, right? The non-Christians, what are they going to say about Jesus? And what are they going to say about God? Even though Jesus has nothing to do with any of these broken individuals, like Jesus hasn't done anything wrong, somehow we got to protect Jesus. And I'm like, wait a minute, what did he do? So, you know, I mean, it's this whole thing, but it's this circling the wagon, dysfunctional thing that you see in broken families. And I'm like, is the church world like a, you know, we like dysfunctional family here, you know, with dysfunctional parents. And so we're doing the same thing. We're you know, we've got to circle the wagons and hide the sins so that all our non-Christian friends won't think bad of us, that we made bad decisions, and they won't think bad of Jesus, even though he had nothing to do with this.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. When I was beginning my research, there was a weird thing that happened to me. So my family was in the upper tier. My grandfather spent time with Branham. Branham was the central figure. I knew most of the upper tier, but I didn't realize there was an upper tier. That's a shock to me. That came to me as I thought there's Branham and there's everybody else, but I realized, no, it's actually a multi-tiered structure.
Right.
When I began to study cult dynamics, and in fact, I went through a crash course with Dr. Stephen Hassan. We went together on a mission to try to help somebody. He was explaining how it all worked, and that's when it really dawned on me. Yes, there was a structure. There were people who were the rank and file members. They were just following. They were the sheeple, I guess you would say. But then there's this category that's between them and the leader that's quite different.
I call that the entourage.
The entourage, yeah. So there's, but it's deeper than that, because some of the entourage can actually be congregational members who are just an average person, but they're in the upper tier for a different reason. And here's where I'm headed with this. People have different psychological makeup. I was born and raised to, my dad would say this phrase over and over again, John, there are two people I hate most in this world, a thief and a liar. And he would say this all the time, usually directing it at me, thinking that I had told him something that wasn't true, which it wasn't quite the case, but he would say this and just grill it into me, and it molded my psyche. So when I found out that, okay, the entire religion that I left was a lie, I had no problem leaving because I am so hardcore against somebody lying. Mm-hmm. That's my makeup. There are other people who aren't wired that way. I have met people who can just straight tell you something that isn't true and not care. And you can, you almost
there's
can't tell it.
Certain cultures, like the Australians, are like that. Their whole culture's like that. You suck. They'll tell you. You suck. You're terrible.
There are so many different complexities to the human makeup. But now think of that pyramid. You got a central figure, and then you've got this group of people. I'm just going to call them a group for now. Whenever somebody looks at cover-up culture, they look at the central figure and they look at the staff. That's always where they go. You can read the newspaper, you can read Rory's report, every single source that I have found, that's where they go. But it actually isn't just that. Yes, that's part of it. But this tier that exists underneath the central figure may be somebody that you don't even really know sitting in that pew who has no problem saying, well, I had a divine revelation from God, and all of this is going to just simply resolve itself. And our leader, even though he's fallen to this great horrific thing, our leader will be justified by God. And in the end, we will get closer to God because of this trial we're going through. And they may actually truly believe it. They may have some sort of a mental disorder, or they may have actually had a dream, who knows. They may believe what they said, but you've got the other category. And in my research in Branhamism, sadly, I identified people I know in this category. The movement itself has a momentum, and if something happens to defame the leader, our momentum stops. I believe in the movement's agenda. I believe that the movement is of God. So therefore, I'm going to give my vindication. I'll just simply say, I was there. I saw this happen. This great light came down from heaven and shone on his head. I saw this kind of thing. There are people who will do this in that middle tier. And they may not be part of the staff. They may even not have a lot of money, but they gain favor by supporting the leader.
Yeah, the reason I call it the entourage is that after my ministry stint, I went into the music world for a decade, and I saw the same dynamics. And that group you're talking about, the reason I call them the entourage is I realized that just like in the church world, there's this tweener tier. And the tweener tier are all people who, and forgive me for just being graphic here, they're leeches. They are whatever. They don't have the star power, right? They don't have the dynamics. You always have that one person that's sort of the figure, right? But they all either make money, they get identity, they get value, they get stature, they get something. They're feeding off of this person's gifting. But they have an investment, right, in making sure that nothing bad can touch this one person, because they're the goose that lays the golden egg, as it were, right? And so we have to protect this at all costs, right? And they will do whatever it takes to protect this. They will lie, cheat, and steal. I've watched it in the church world. I've watched it in the music world. I've watched it in other sectors, these same dynamics, right? And so to your point, you know, somebody that's not even on staff, but because of their proximity, they're a friend of the star, right? But their identity then, when they go back out into the congregation, is their other, right? They're a little elevated, right? So they're still gaining something. So they're all feeding off of this. And that's that middle group that I think you're describing. The word I'm looking for was vested interest. They all have a vested interest in circling the wagons, preserving the mythology, the culture, the spiritual history. You know, that's why you see all the time, in, at least in my world here in Kansas City, we have to preserve the prophetic history at all costs, right? And there's a reason why. It's like I ask people all the time, why do you think they're so obsessed with that? Because what happens if you take it away?
So let's talk about prophetic history a bit. When I was researching Branhamism, the foundation of all of this that we're talking about today. In Branhamism, there's this weird cloud picture, and you've seen it if you've ever looked at anything Branham. You see this thing, and I had no idea that this was an object of worship until after I left. We believe that the cloud was seven angels because Branham told us so. And that's part of where I'm headed with this, so keep that thought in mind. In the tale, Branham goes west hunting, and he receives the revelation of the seven seals, and he claims that he was there right when this cloud thing happened. Well, if you piece the timeline together correctly, and we have all of the history to do it, he actually wasn't in the state of Arizona at the time this happened. The cloud was actually the result of a rocket that had been launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Branham was down in Houston, Texas with Joel Osteen and the Full Gospel Businessmen trying to save a transgender from death row. And so he wasn't
John
even there.
Osteen.
John Osteen. Said Joel. I meant John.
Yeah. Joel's the kid. He would have been in diapers.
Yeah, he was in diapers. He was probably there, but who knows? Yeah. Anyway, he wasn't even in the state is the point I'm trying to make.
Got it.
So he sees this thing, and he puts two and three together. Wow, this is a great, unusual event. I can use this to further my ministry. So he is just outright lying, right? That's what he's doing. Well,
he's embellishing.
He's embellishing. Well, that middle tier, the ones who were with him but not at the time this thing happened, became witnesses that they were there when it happened. I was with him when it happened. And I grew up hearing testimonies of these guys who were out there with him on that trip. And I looked up and I saw this thing. Some of them did change their story later to say, I never saw it, I heard it. Right. But there was a point in time when they were joining in. And some of the guys, like I know of these people, some of them I knew personally, some of them I just knew of them, and they were very humble, meek kind of people. They weren't really the kind of people to lie to you.
Right.
What happens is this, whenever you tie something, when you have that scenario that I mentioned, the invention of lying, the central figure lies, you have these people that are trying to support it. Well, now it starts this cycle that's really weird because... Mm-hmm. The supporter just confirmed it. All the congregation believes it. Well, the central figure tries to build upon the confirmation. So they'll add details, they'll embellish. And if somebody is either mentally unstable and just starts hallucinating or having, you know, going down a path of mental anguish, they can spin off all the craziest tales that you can possibly imagine to feed that confirmation. Well, then the people go back to the person who gave the confirmation. Did you see that? Did you see that detail? Tell us more. Tell us more. And so now this person is starting to get excited because they have a special insight nobody else has.
Right. I
was there. The wrong kind of people will also embellish the story.
Yeah.
And you and I have talked about this a few times. Over time, your mind loses the frame of reference. And so there is no true witness.
Yeah, you start believing your own lies.
You start believing your own lies. Or they may hear the central figure's lies and say, oh, yeah, I think I did see that. And then their mind will run with it. And so the story in their own head gets bigger than it really was. What happens when you do this, if you tie this to something spiritual, like I got the seven the secret mysteries behind the seven seals. Well, now it's tied to something prophetic because you can point that to the future about a future coming event. I know the secret.
Yeah.
The moment that it turns to prophecy, when you've got this cycle, now you have a hook that can't be released because if they cover it up and continue, they can see, is this thing true or is this thing not true? In the back of their minds, they're thinking, well, I'm not going to stop this guy if he's done something horrific. I'm going to let it continue and see, did the prophecy come true? But by the time they wait, they've long forgotten that this thing that they covered up was even covered up.
Yeah. And for people that may or may not be aware, we know scientifically in the psychology world that you can actually put false memories into people. In other words, to the point where they really believe they were there. Like they're so convinced of it. There's a whole manipulative way you can do that. That's why you have to be very, very careful when you're doing counseling and you're talking about memories, because, you know, people may remember things, but it may not necessarily be true. So, yeah, the other dynamic there, I think that underlies a lot of that is that, you know, while our number one human instinct may be survival, probably right up there underneath it is this human need to belong, to be a part of something, right? We are very tribal or family, right? You know, we have subcultures, you know, that we belong to because we need to belong, right? So I always tell people, when you are on the opposite side of an issue with someone and they start getting upset, it's more than likely, it's not about your difference in your arguments. It's what the implications are if they have to change their mind with all their relationships. That's where people start freaking out and they start getting agitated and they start getting aggressive. It's the repercussions. It's where this leads to, because in their brain, it's like, oh my God, you know, if I change my mind and agree with you, I'm gonna lose all my friends. Like my family's gonna isolate me, right? So fear kicks in, and so it becomes, so they get more aggressive and they're arguing with you, but it has nothing to really do with the facts and everything to do with fear. And so it's the same thing, I think, in the church world. It's that fear of being ostracized or looked down on, right? So that's why people are so easily manipulated in group thing. That's why we have cults, right? It's the whole idea here is that we have to be loyal to this thing, right? Which, again, if you go back and you remember what I just talked about a little while ago about dysfunctional families and false narratives and circling the wagons and this demand for loyalty. It's everything you see in a dysfunctional alcoholic or drug addict family is the same thing, same dynamics you see in a cult, right? I saw the same thing in the music world. I mean, there's a whole story I remember of Elton John talking about after he got out of rehab. And they were asking him, like, well, what's the number one thing you realize? He says, no one told me the truth. He goes, I've been living in a fantasy world and I didn't even know it, because everyone had a hidden agenda. Everybody was, you know, had a motivation to keep feeding him the BS, right? Because they were all afraid if I confront him and tell him the truth, that, you know, that's what he finally said at the end of the thing, is I was a jerk, you know, like I was not a nice person, but nobody would tell me that, right? Because they were all afraid of the implications of what would happen, because if Elton didn't like that, I'm gone. Like I'm out of the entourage now. I lose my access to status and stuff, right? And so people will compromise and perpetuate lies out of just the simple fear of isolation or being rejected. And again, these are the very human realities of our weaknesses as human beings. So I'm not here to point fingers or condemn anybody, but just realize who we are and what we are and what our strengths and weaknesses are. And so that's one of the reasons why I actually have compassion and empathy for people that are caught in this, because I realize that I'm not looking at somebody who's put a flag in the ground and, you know, they're standing for a cause. I'm looking at a very scared, you know, sort of like the, you know, the Wizard of Oz, right? The little shaking old man behind the curtain. Don't mind the man, right? It's like most people are living in fear of the implications of things, right? And so I feel bad for people, actually. I feel terrible that they get caught in this, you know, these dynamics, these power struggles.
Yeah, I feel bad too. And there's, so in the beginning, I said that this is similar to the invention of lying. There was an invention of lying in this culture that caused a lot of this. And I don't know if you know this or not. I think we've talked about it. But so let's compare a bit. If you're looking at the Catholic cover-up culture, which is what the Protestants usually point fingers, the Catholics are doing this, right? It is different in this aspect. There has been a history, which is actually, they're trying to correct it. So I see some strides in the right way, where the church covered up for the church. on the Protestant side, in the charismatic movement specifically, the congregation covers up the leader. It's quite different. Those are two different models entirely. And there's a reason for it, in my opinion.
Okay.
It all goes back to the invention of lying. There was a lie that was told, and every generation that I've looked at in history, every century that I've looked at in history, where this exists, well, every decade, I should say, where this exists, it's like a snowball. It gets bigger. Mm. The lie gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. And that's positive confession. The invention of lying is that I'm going to start a revival. I'm going to bring 10,000 people in this tent, or five, whatever, however your tent will hold. And every single person who comes through that healing line, I'm going to have them confess that they are healed. But when I go to the next town, I'm going to say that 10,000 people were healed. I'm not going to say 10,000 people confessed that they were healed. I'm going to say they were actually healed. Mm-hmm. That's where the lie begins. Because I grew up hearing stories how, not just with Branham, but all of these healing revivalists, they would enter into a tent and God was so filled our spirits with that tent, 10,000 people left their crutches behind. Then you go back and you read the newspaper. There were newspaper reporters present at the tent revivals. And they would say, there were 10,000 people that went through this line. And they left their crutches, but they never made it off stage. They had to get their crutches again to make it off stage. Mm-hmm. They tried, but they did confess they were healed. And I even found newspaper articles that said they came on crutches and stretchers and wheelchairs, and they left on crutches and stretchers. Yeah. But when you hear the history part, they say there were so many people healed. It was the most amazing move of God. We've never seen anything like it. You had all of these healings and prophecy, and it caused growth and crowds. Well, there is a hype that grows. Whenever you're part of something that's that extravagant, suddenly you feel like you're contributing to part of the crowd, the audience, the spirit. And there were people that would say, I felt the spirit when I was there. What they felt was the crowd. Mm-hmm. You can have the same type of people. You mentioned music. You can have the same type of effect if you go hear a good concert by a band that you are a fan of, right? You get into that euphoria of being in the crowd. Well, suddenly you become part of the invention of lying. I saw 10,000 people confess that they were healed. You go tell everybody at work, 10,000 people were healed at that tent. But you're not telling it true. It's 10,000 people confess they were healed, right?
My suspicion, and again, you know, you can probably more knowledgeable about this than I am, so you can address the Branham side of this. I was actually having a conversation yesterday with some guys that flew in town, and I was explaining Mike. I said, when you grow up in the circle of the wagons culture, you are a liar. That's your normal. Right? You lie all the time. You don't see it, right? You don't see it as lying, because it's your norm. And so most of these guys, I don't want to say most, many of the guys that I've done my research on or worked with came from very broken backgrounds and started lying as children. And lying is their norm in everything. I mean, they lie when they don't even need to lie. But everything, and when I'm saying lying, you know, people always think of lying as simply telling an untruth. And that's true. But that's why I threw the word embellishment in there. Because a lot of times what these guys do is take something this big. You know, it's like the fisherman, right? How big was the fish? It was this big. It was this big, right? And that becomes normal. And that's one of the things that I discovered within the church world is there's this propensity to embellish. We want every story to be bigger than that. Now, here's what's so fascinating about this. Back in the 1980s, I had the opportunity to meet Norman Grubb, who was the author of Rees Hall's Intercessor, which was the book that was most influential in Mike Bickle's life. And I was telling him about my experience at Bible College, where first time I'm learning about Hudson Taylor and C.T. Studd and all these great missionaries. And I said to him, I go, Norman, I got to confess something to you. I said, I can't explain this, but I have this feeling like I'm reading a book that's really hyped up. Like, it's like these guys are bigger than life. Like, it's like these books are presenting these guys like they're heroic. And he starts laughing. He's 90 years old. His hands are like this. He's sitting in a couch under a blanket. He starts laughing. He goes, "Young man, you're very perceptive." And I was like, "Huh, this is interesting." I thought he was going to get mad at me, right? Because C.T. Studd was his father-in-law. And then he says to me, "You have to understand something, young man." He goes, "Back in those days, there was only one source of financing for the missionaries, and it was the London Missionary Society." He goes, "These guys were all competing for the same bucks." He goes, "Every report that came from the field was embellished because they had to, you know." He goes, "My father-in-law was an athlete. He was super competitive. He was bound and determined he was going to outdo Hudson Taylor, who was going to outdo Carey, who was in India. Like, these guys were, right?" And he goes, "So yes, it's all embellished." I literally sat there stunned, right? That this man who knew Evangeline Booth firsthand, like this was his friend, right, is telling me these stories at a very early part of my faith walk, right? Real. And so I was kind of introduced to this embellishment culture in the ministry world, realizing that it just didn't start in 1930 or 1980. This goes back to the 1800s and probably even before that, because why? It's human nature.
Well, I would say that it goes all the way back to the ancient religions. We've talked before how something normal would develop and grow into a tale, and the tale to a legend, and the legend to sacrificing your children to a deity. Yeah. That's really, and it comes down to that, because what happens is when you wrap human nature into trying to understand God through another human, that other human has emotional aspects, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're in a bad mood. God's angry at you. Right. Well, when God gets angry at you, what do? You try to appease the God. Mm-hmm. When you're in this type of culture where you've got the revival, the hype, the charismatic style, there's always an aspect of fear and urgency. And mm-hmm. those two things, that combination, helps fuel the cover-up culture, in my opinion, because you have to appease the God. God's angry. Well, what can I do to make, not just me, but what can I do to make the whole body of believers believe? Your mind starts spinning out of control, and you may do and say things that you wouldn't otherwise do and say because you're part of that culture. You may, going back to my example, you may affirm the leader, "I was standing there with him," when you weren't even there. That's just how your mind works.
Well, in the Catholic culture, the worst sin is a mortal sin, right? We call it a mortal sin. Well, the mortal sin and Pentecostalism is not having faith, brother.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's like, to challenge anything, brother, you lack faith, right? That's like the worst thing. So nobody wants to get accused of that. Like, and you're in the congregation, you know, nobody's going to speak up and go, "Hey, he's got no clothes," right? Brother, you lack faith.
Yeah.
They're coming. I'm sorry, I'm just being weird here, but I'm just saying, that's to your point. It's like when you're sitting out there and you're in the congregation, there's so much pressure on you. You know, the thing that does happen, though, as you get older, then people just walk. You know what I mean? They just, like, you get to a certain point going, "Okay, wait a minute here. You know, this is just," it's sort of like Pentecostalism to me, in many ways, is sort of like an injection of nitro in your gas tank. Well, the problem is that you keep injecting nitro into your gas tank, there's a certain point where the engine's going to blow. And I think there's an addictive culture in Pentecostalism towards this sensationalism, right? This exaggeration, this embellishment, these lies, right? And I think what happens is some people who have sort of an addictive nature, they just keep feeding on that, right? That's their food. There's another group of people that it just exhausts, and it's just like, "God, not again," you know? And it's like that happened in Kansas City, because it was just constantly Bob Jones every year was going to be the one, right? Every year. "Oh, next year it's coming. Next year," right? This went on for, you know, when I was there, it went on for like 8 years, right? It was always the next year. "Oh, when the Chiefs win the Super Bowl." And so people were constantly hanging on. Then there's a certain point where you're like, "Okay, I got to move on here, right? Yeah. Something ain't adding up here, you know?
Yeah.
Now we've won 3 Super Bowls and it still hasn't come. So there's, you know, the older group is, you know, well, now everybody here, you know, even with the IHOP thing, everybody's relooking at everything now going, huh, you know? And I heard recently Sam Storms came out with a book where he's kind of reevaluating his worldview of a lot of this because he was one of the big proponents behind all this. And, you know, we're having this come to Jesus moment, right? It's sort of like an intervention, right? Sober up. And that's something that it feels to me, again, this is just me kind of giving my sense of things. I feel like we're in a sober up. We've been in 2 years of sober up. You know, so, you know, whether the, again, I'm hoping it's God, it's the Holy Spirit just going, sober up, people. You know, I want to do something, but sober up here, you know.
I'm glad that we can sober you up. Trying to think of a good snappy ending.
I thought we could close with something. There's been a lot of negativity, and that could really take you down the rabbit hole, right? It's just depressing. The other side of this is, well, wait a minute. What if this is God trying to get us better? You know, one of the things that I'm having a problem with some of my former ministry colleagues is that they look at guys like us as guys that are bringing criticism towards them and the church. And I've told them all, I said, you know, I suppose from your perspective, because you're kind of touchy about this, it appears to be criticism. But I said, I live in a world where I work with pro athletes that every Monday after a football game go in their position rooms and they watch film. And they get embarrassed because they missed a block. They ran the wrong pattern. They're being held accountable. Why? Because they want to win the next week, right? The whole idea is, let's look at this, let's evaluate. That's called critique. It's a very different dynamic than criticism. Criticism is simply about tearing people down. That's neither you and I want to do that. That is not our goal. You know, we're not here to criticize anyone. What we want to do is critique, right? It's the same thing in the business world. A sales proposal goes bad, like we lost to somebody else. Why? Everybody goes in the boardroom. We tear it apart. What should we have done different, right? Why? Because we want to win the next time. So I wrote a book to critique my, you know, to look back on the experience of my life. Why? Because I want things to be better. We all do, right? So that's the difference. So when you see guys get upset and go, well, they're being critical. No, not at all. It's all about critique, which is the normal thing that healthy people do when they want to overcome their failures and get better. That's what happens when you go to rehab. Like, you know what I mean? They get in your face and go, you are not taking personal responsibility for your own problems, right? They're in your face about it. So that's what we can take away in the positive side. Just realize we're in one of those moments right now, but that's all because it's about getting better.
Absolutely. Like, text criticism is a study of the Bible, not to criticize the Bible, but to critique it and understand which families are true, which families have the right text. But thank you so much for doing this. I've been wanting to do this for a while, and I'm glad we were able to cover it.
Well, thank you. Despite my jet lag and all of that, it's been an absolutely stimulating conversation, and I think you've sobered me up.
I'm glad I sobered you up. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR. And for more about Mike Bickle and IHOP KC, you can read Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, The Kansas City Prophets, and The International House of Prayer.